This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is the evening edition with Lynn and Calvin. We're taking a look back at everything that 2018 has brought, and we couldn't do that without addressing the first change of government this country has seen and the election that brought us to it. With us today to discuss that is Serena Abdul Rahman, visiting fellow from the Malaysia Studies Program at the ISC's Yusof Ishak Institute. Serena, let's start with this. What was your read of sentiments on the ground heading into GE14, and did you expect or anticipate the results?
Definitely not. So in everything that I was writing and saying in the build-up to the elections, I kept saying, yes, people were unhappy, cost of living is an issue, people are complaining about GST, loss of subsidies, but they're still going to vote for BN and UMNO. And this is because whoever I spoke to, they said that they had always voted for BN and UMNO. And the parents were telling them, you have to vote for BN and UMNO. These were generational supporters of the party because Johor, as you know, is the birthplace of UMNO. And so the support for them in terms of percentages over the years in past elections have been very high. It's above 80, 90%. So even when there was a national dip in support for UMNO and BN in the last few elections, it never went down to below 70%, which meant there was enough buffer for this party to have a decrease in support, but still win overall well above 50%. So we never expected Johor to fall. And the people that we spoke to were like, no, you can't vote anybody else because only BN or UMNO will support Malay rights. If we vote for anybody else, we'll lose Malay identity. Islam will no longer be the religion of the country. Royalty will be wiped out. And so with all of that, I was convinced that it would hang on.
You mentioned something about generational support. Could you elaborate on that a bit more?
So what happens is, because UMNO has been around for the longest time, a lot of the older generations feel like they owe a lot to them. So in the Felda areas, they would say things like, you know, before we had nothing, there was lalang growing up between the planks of our house, and now because of Tun Razza, because of Najib, we have come so far. Look at our houses now, we're very comfortable, we have everything. And so these older, actually the pioneering Felda generation, they felt that, you know, it's adat. We have to remember those who have helped us. And it goes against adat, it goes against culture to vote against them. So of course the Felda areas have, you know, there are no stalwarts on the east coast of Johor. And so even when I was speaking to the second generation Felda settlers, so these are the children of the pioneering generation, they would tell me in whispers, you know, actually it's very hard. Felda gives a lot of money to our parents, but we cannot always turn to our parents like they're ATMs. You know, our parents don't know how hard it is to put children through school, how much cost we have to face. There are no jobs for us. We have to come back to Felda because our parents are getting old, but there's nothing for us. But at the end of the day, we will still support UMNO and BN because look at Singapore. If we don't vote for them, then the Chinese will take over and then we'll be in trouble. And at the same time, the parents who are eavesdropping on these conversations and these focus groups, they're saying, no, remember, we have to support BN. Don't change your mind. Don't go against the family traditions. And that's what it means to be a generational supporter.
So what were some of the key issues dominating the discourse, I mean, during the elections in different parts of the country, especially through the lens you are viewing it through in these conversations with rural voters?
Well, I spoke largely to fishermen and farmers in Johor and in Kedah. So in Kedah, it was very different. In Kedah, they were straight out like, oh, we love Tun M, we love Mukriz. You know, we can't wait for the elections. We're going to vote for Parti Raya, Parti Bunga. Yeah, so it was very clear they were in support, especially the younger voters. The older ones, you could see, yeah, things have not been so good. Perhaps they were a bit reluctant to go all out to say that they were in support of the then opposition. I think some of the issues really were peer pressure to not vote against BN or UMNO. In Johor, it was different. On the east coast, where the Felda settlers were, as I mentioned just now, they were in support, and the younger generation were pressured to continue that support. When it came to the fishermen, it varied between the genders and the ages. So the women were all in strong support of BN and UMNO. Of course, when you listen to the rallies, they will say, they will just keep repeating this whole loss of Malay identity, that Malays who supported the opposition were liberal, and they cited examples, and that, you know, the DAP was controlling the opposition. So there were lots of, it was politics of fear, really, that came around. But the fishermen themselves were a bit more ambivalent. So they were like, yeah, you know, they give us brim, but they take away so much more. They promised us so many things in the last elections, but we still didn't get anything. And then on top of that, they were saying things like, you know, we struggle to put food on the table, but they're out there spending a lot of money. But at the end of the day, when I asked them, they said, no, whatever it is, we must have Malays in power. The difference is that amongst the fishermen, some of them were like, when one person said that, the other would say, yeah, we have Malays in power now, but we're still suffering. And then the conclusion that they gave at the end of it was, well, if it rains or if there's a good catch that day, we just won't go to vote. Whereas on the East, there was no such thing. It was just straight out, we're in support. If I asked them about 1MDB, they would say, no, that's all fake news. And so they did not believe the chatter about the scandals for BM.
So it was a particularly embittered campaign that was run on both sides with a lot of attacks. What did you make of the messaging at the time?
So it was very clear that, and this is what struck a chord with the rural people that perhaps changed the vote. There was a lot of condemnation of Tun Mahathir from the UMNO side. And to the rural people, this rankled. So while they might not necessarily believe the 1MDB stories, they did not like that people were so petty with Tun Mahathir. So when they saw pictures and videos of his face being cut out of banners, when they saw that there were issues on nomination day, they thought that that was going overboard. Because, you know, in traditional villages, adat is very important. So there are things that you just cannot cross when it comes to culture. So being so disrespectful of an elder statesman, even though they themselves were not necessarily in support of this man as they were in Kedah, that really struck a chord with them. And people started asking, what is Najib afraid of? And I think that really pushed them over to the other side at the very last minute.
We're speaking today with Serena Abdulrahman, visiting fellow from the Malaysia Studies program at the ICU's Yusof Ishak Institute. We're talking about GE14, specifically, I suppose, through the lens of voters that we don't think about enough, perhaps in the urban areas, namely rural voters. Up next, we continue our conversation discussing the main causes that led to Pakatan winning the election. You are listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Beyond Frivolous Matters, BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
This is the Evening Edition with Lynn and Kelvin. Joining us in the studio, Serena Abdulrahman, visiting fellow from the Malaysia Studies program at the IC's Yusof Ishak Institute, and we're talking about GE14. So what were the main causes then, in retrospect, that led to Pakatan Harapan winning the election? You mentioned that at the time you were surprised by it. It was not something you'd anticipated. Now, looking back, what do you think it was?
To be honest, I think when the rural folks, well, in Kedah, they had already intended to vote that way. But in Johor especially, when they voted on election day, it was a vote of protest. For many of them, it was a last-minute decision. So some told me, yeah, we were still not sure, but as we were walking up to the voting booth, we heard other people saying, look, I voted the other way, you can too. So there was a realization that, okay, there are people who are voting the other way. And there were others, interestingly, who went through the motion of supporting BN. They would put up the flags, the banners, give out T-shirts, but inside they'd already decided, I'm going to vote opposition, because they'd had enough. But the peer pressure is so strong. The parental pressure is so strong. I know of families where the youth, the younger voters, explicitly said, you know, I'm opposition, and it was war in the family. Like, the parents were like, you're embarrassing us, look, you're ruining the family name, how can you go against them? So there were people who were hiding their support, and they didn't say all the right things about supporting BN. There were others that were pushed over, as I mentioned, at the last minute because of the disrespect towards Tun Mahathir. And there were others who just decided, yeah, I know this BN person has supported us, I just apologized on the day because this is the only chance we have to get rid of GST. The opposition says we'll get rid of GST, and we need to get rid of GST because it's just too expensive now. And so for others, you know, it was a vote of protest. It was a last minute thing. So the thing to notice is with the rural people, it was not like everybody got out and said, okay, I'm going to do this. You know, it's part of a plan. You know, it's not an orchestrated thing. I think the then opposition would have wanted it to be that way, but it wasn't. I think individuals actually just thought, I have to do this because I can't afford to live anymore. I have to protest. You know, I can't stand Najib. I can't stand Rosma. I'm just going to do it. And when the election results came out, they were shocked. And it was the bewilderment and guilt that I got the day after, immediately after the results came out. At 2 a.m., I was getting messages. You know, they were saying, oh no, what have I done? I can't believe Johor has fallen. What did I do? This is wrong. What have I done? And there's so much guilt of people who had... did not actually have anything against BN. Maybe they were just not happy with Najib and Rosma. They were not happy with the corruption at the lower levels. 1MDB didn't matter to them. They didn't understand it, right? They don't understand the political processes. But they felt the pain at the lower levels where village heads or association heads were blocking off benefits that they felt they deserved. And all of that sort of built up in this kind of anger that burst on election day. But the morning after, they regretted what they did when they realized that the government had fallen.
You know, there's so much to take away from that, but I think maybe let's start with, you know, how much of an impact did the Pakatan Harapan Manifesto have on swaying the mind of electorates? You said that when they promised to remove GST, that was a message that kind of resonated with some of the voters there.
Yeah, I think it was all about cost of living. It was the difficulty of putting food on the table that got it. And so in rural areas, to be honest, they're not interested in the political processes. They don't believe the political rhetoric. They only understand their lived experience. So whatever is the immediate reality for them, that is what matters. There is, of course, more than 60 years of indoctrination, of fear, that if you don't vote the way you have always voted, you will lose your identity. The rallies that they had in the kampung, they would always say, you know, if you allow the opposition to come, then opposition to come in, they will remove the pillars of your home. And the pillars, like literally the pillars of the roof of your home, one is your Malay rights, one is Islam as the main religion, and one is royalty. So if you bring them in one by one, they will remove these pillars and your roof will fall on your head. What will happen to the Malay people? What will happen to Malaysia? Don't allow that. That is the rhetoric that was resonating throughout the villages.
That's a very powerful message.
It is. It's very visual.
And, yes, it is.
You know, that really pulled people to think, we cannot allow the roofs to collapse on us. But at the end of the day, they're also thinking, yeah, our roofs collapse, but we have no food to put on the table because people in the rural areas really struggle. I think in urban areas, you mentioned just now that we don't think about the people out there, but I think we also don't realize how hard it is. And, you know, to us, maybe we think, what's up with the rural people? You know, they get 100 ringgit from Brim and they're so easy to bribe. It's not that. It is that 100 ringgit cash makes so much difference. It's not that they're lazy. You know, they work really hard, but because they only scrape by with so few things, cash is so hard to come by. End of the year, when they need to pay for so many things to put their kids through school, every extra 50 ringgit counts for a lot. So Brim actually makes a huge difference, even though it's, what, 200 ringgit plus at a time? But that, you know, that pays for school bags, that pays for diapers, you know, that they sometimes really struggle to get. So for us, 100 ringgit you can spend just going to eat one day, but it makes a lot of difference to them. And they are dependent on it simply because it is so hard to survive.
I'm just curious to know whether that sense of regret and anxiety has stuck around. It's one thing, I suppose, the next day to, in the immediacy of it all, to be, oh no, I can't believe what I did. But now we are 7 months out from that. Is there still that sense of anxiety and regret? Has it stuck around? Has it lingered?
No, it's despair. Mm. So in the immediate aftermath, when I was walking around the village or sitting at the warungs with the fishermen, they would just gather around and look lost. And, you know, I would always hear, who's going to help us now? What do we do? This new government, they're going to take away Brim. They're going to cut all this assistance. Who's going to help us now? What do we do? There was like a loss. People didn't know what to do. There were others who were actually discussing how they could reposition themselves to continue benefiting from the gravy train of the new government, because they did not know any other way to govern other than patronage politics. So they expected this new government to come in and give out handouts or line the way of things with projects as they did in the past. So there were some like trying to figure out how we can continue to benefit. There were others who were just completely lost and in despair. And then there was the UMNO cyber troopers that stepped in within a week to say, oh no, don't worry, Pakatan Harapan will not be there until the next elections. We're going to come back into power. While in urban areas, people were still discussing, is, you know, PAS and UMNO going to collaborate? In rural areas, it was a sure thing. They were saying, oh no, we're all going to come together. We need to do this for religion, for race. You know, Pakatan, they were... not memes, but those pictures going around on WhatsApp showing that UMNO and PAS were already a sure thing. Stories about Tun Mahathir not handing over to Anwar were rife already within a couple of weeks. And people were saying, oh, look, Anwar is more religious than Tun M. And, you know, Tun M and this opposition is very secular. So our only hope is Anwar, and we will pull him over to UMNO and PAS. This was like a done deal in rural areas. So it was a very stark contrast to what I was hearing in urban areas, because this is what the UMNO cyber troopers were passing on, and people believed it. Then on the other hand, with the cabinet appointments, with finance minister being Chinese, with chief justice, with AG coming out not being Malay, then the news came out that, oh, look, this is our Chinese government now. You know, this is what we've elected. So the people who did vote the other way, the guilt sort of accelerated, right? And it became more entrenched. And then there were those who were like, look at the impertinence of these other people. Now we have a Chinese government in charge. People are daring to stand up and go to a mosque. This happened in Ulutiram. So it very quickly spread. All these racist issues started to spread, whether by WhatsApp or at the warungs. And I would hear them say, yeah, this person in Ulutiram, they dare now to go to the mosque and ask them to lower the volume. This can only happen because we have a Chinese government. We need to go and fight. We need to take arms. They were encouraging violence. They were saying, let's all go to Ulutiram. You know, it's about an hour and a half drive away. We need to go there and prevent this from happening. Never mind, we'll shed blood, because the faster we do that, the faster we'll get rid of this Chinese government. It was horrifying, but it was getting worse.
We're speaking to Serena Abdul Rahman, visiting fellow from the Malaysia Studies Program at the ICSU Sof Ishak Institute. We've been talking about the reactions and sentiments of voters, particularly those in rural Malaysia, after the election of the new government. Coming up, we take a look at the measures that the Pakatan Harapan government have or have not yet taken to address the anxieties of the electorate that Serena just spoke about. You're listening to BFM 89.9.
Become fabulous millionaires. BFM 89.9.
It's the evening edition with Lynn and Kelvin. We've been taking a look back at one of the key events to happen in 2018, which was GE14, of course. Joining us is Serena Abdul Rahman, visiting fellow from the Malaysia Studies Program at the IC's Yusof Ishak Institute. Just a little bit earlier, Serena, you spoke about the divisive racial rhetoric that was already growing in the wake of the GE14 elections. And listening to this, I do feel a sense of a very deep struggle in terms of communication, right? So when you have such different mindsets, such different rhetoric being spun in different parts of the country, is the role then of the government to bridge the gap, or is it to try to communicate entirely differently to different sets of people? I mean, I understand that it's not your position to strategize on behalf of the government, but just listening to that, I had no idea how to bridge that gap.
Yeah, I think it's a very different world. You know, the government lives in an urban setting where, even for me, the contrast was like the euphoria, the excitement that, you know, there was regime change without a drop of blood, and it's democracy that has never been done before. After 60 years, there's all these celebrations. And then you look at the rural areas. Okay, not Kedah. Kedah was celebrating as well. But in Johor especially, where people were stunned, right? It's complete contrast. And then all the decisions that were made by the new government were done in an urban setting. And I think there was a lot of dismissive comments of the rural people and their needs and their wants and their fears. So there is... I think there's just no communication to rural areas. But on top of that, there's also UMNO monopoly of communication. You know, the UMNO and BN cyber troopers are there. And the issue really stems from the then opposition of Pakatan Rakyat, Pakatan Harapan, and PKR before, of not having this grassroots machinery at all. So whatever is said of UMNO, you have to admit that their grassroots machinery is amazing. And it's not just that they are out there. A lot of them are out there and helping people. So whatever their political intentions or whatever their goal behind helping people, they did help people. And these rural people depended on that. These people were present. They were there at funerals. They were there at weddings. They were there to give out prizes in schools. And this made them part of the society.
Yeah.
So that when it came to voting, they would vote for somebody that they knew. So yes, maybe Pakatan Harapan or Pakatan Rakyat promised better things for the overall country. They didn't. Rural people don't understand that. It is too far away from them to matter. What they know is this person is here, he's with UMNO, and he's always helped us. If we're in trouble, you know, he comes in the middle of the night. And that matters to people. And like in some parts of Johor, the opposition, then opposition, had taken control, right? DAP, for example. But they never saw any of these people. You know, there's all these promises, but they never came to the ground. There is no grassroots movement from them. Perhaps also, and this is what happened in many places, the UMNO grassroots people did not allow the then opposition to come in as well. So, you know, they're entrenched. The administration there was all UMNO. So, okay, la, if in 1 year this opposition came in, like in GE13, they were not able to come in. But there really is no grassroots machinery in the current government as there is in the past. So what this government really needs to do is to make an extra effort in rural areas. They need to reach out to rural areas and not be so dismissive. Because I have heard, you know, I guess reformists celebrate this win. And when they think about rural areas, 2/3 of the Malay rural citizens voted for PAS or UMNO. And they're like, ah, these people don't know what they're voting for. They don't know any better. They're stuck in this racial, religious boxes. I mean, I said that as well. But these people matter because the rural voting bloc is huge. And these are citizens too, right? It's not just people in urban areas. So there needs to be a way to reach out to them in a manner that they can relate to. And that is not talking about transparency, institutional change, and things like this. It is not talking about 1MDB. It is talking about things that matter to them on a daily basis. If we're talking about providing assistance on a needs basis, not on a racial mix, right? All they hear is, you're going to take away my rights as a Malay. But if they see with their own eyes that there's somebody here from this new government who is talking to us, he's sitting at the warung with us, he's asking us what our issues are, then they'll start to believe it. There is so much disillusionment now. You are asking how it is now. The despair and disillusionment is very strong. So it's come to a point where the ICERD rally last weekend or the weekend before, some people in Johor were like, ah, they want to protest. Both sides are bad. You know, it doesn't matter who's in power. We're not going to get anything out of it. So while there is this fear of losing religious and racial rights, many of them are also like, it doesn't matter who's in power, we're going to suffer anyway. So what this government needs to do, as I said just now, is to be present and to physically be seen listening and trying to solve their problems. Talk, policies, structures, the need for better national security is not going to help. You know, we've been trying to secure our borders a lot more. So what's happened with the fishermen is that the marine police have been going out and being extra strict and checking people's licenses. So the fishermen are like, I'm trying to make a living here and you're stopping me? Yes, I don't have a license, but we've applied for licenses and we didn't get it. And that's a corruption issue at the association level, the fishing association level. But they don't know, they don't understand that. All they know is you're preventing me from surviving, from putting food on my family's table. This is what the new government is doing. You know, all these extra measures, this is what the government is doing. We shouldn't have voted the other way. So unless they see that people are trying to help them and just sincerely be there to listen to them, it's not going to get any better.
So it might be some time, I guess, before benefits of new policies and provisions in Budget 2019 are felt by groups like the B40. What can be done to convince marginalized groups that action is being taken without compromising, I guess, the government's vision for a better, more progressive Malaysia?
Go down to the kampungs and talk to people. Really, that's it. It's actually not that difficult to get these people on your side.
It's about assurance, I feel. I mean, from what you're saying, it sounds as if there is that sense of social assurance and security that's required of just being able to know who it is that you can go to.
And it's also not coming in as if I'm an urban person. Mm. I'm so-and-so with this status. I am more educated than you are. It's not to come in like that. It's to come in as we are all Rakyat Malaysia. This is our country. To speak to them in simple Malay. To sit with them and have teh tarik and ask them, how are you doing, Cik? You know, how's your family? Are you able to put food on the table? What are your problems? How can I help you? Without having the airs of people who are so much better well off coming in to talk down to people. This is an issue. To come in without this huge entourage and show that in your expensive car that, you know, you're so comfortable and you're coming here and talking down to us. You know, these are the issues. Come and talk to them like real people. Come and talk to them like they are real people and that they matter. Talk to them like they are the elders in your family and you respect them. Give them the due respect that they deserve as citizens of this country. And forget that they voted for UMNO PAS. Forget that they might be antagonistic because they don't trust you, because people are always coming in and using them. You know, if you can get past that and behave like there's just anybody else in an urban area, then they would start to believe you. It's very experiential in rural areas. They need to see and believe. And they're not stupid. They can see through insincerity. They can see if you're just putting on a front. Yeah, respect.
We'll return with Serena Abdul Rahman, visiting fellow from the Malaysia Studies Program at the IC's Yusof Ishak Institute, to speak about whether we're going to move away or continue to relate to the identity politics that has been so deeply embedded into the Malaysian mindset. It's the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Be firmly motivated. BFM 89.9.
It's the Evening Edition with Lynn and Kelvin. We've been taking a look back at GE14 with Serena Abdul Rahman, visiting fellow from the Malaysia Studies Program at the IC's Yusof Ishak Institute. Both pre and post GE14, conversations around identity politics have continued to bubble. Will we ever move away from it? Or is it something that's woven into a part of our country? And when I listened to you speak earlier about that messaging of the roof of the house, you know, the pillars that are required to support that roof of religion and race and royalty, do you think we will ever hit a point where we're ready to kind of collectively move away from this? Because there is that disparity in terms of messaging.
Yeah, this is a huge concern. When you look at the anti-ICERT rally or celebration, whatever they called it, you notice they were all wearing white. They were no longer wearing the blue and green of PAS and UMNO. This takes this struggle to a higher level, because this white represents the colour of pilgrimage, of purity, of religion. So now it's, to me, I think it's gone beyond just ethnic divide. Now they're using religion. And this is a very powerful tool. It can be a very dangerous tool. We do not want to deteriorate into France. No offence to French people. But, you know, this is actually quite a harmonious, peaceful society compared to many other places in the world. But if we don't try to find a way to overcome these cracks, I think after the elections, because the vitriol got so much louder before and after, I think the fissures have gone a lot deeper. There is a danger that this then could escalate into violent action, into radical extremism. It can go to the very extremes. We also need to understand that ethnic divisions have been around for a long time, for decades. You know, this was how the people in power from the time of the sultanates did divide and rule. The colonial powers made it worse. They used this divide and rule tactics to keep the sultans on their side, to keep the Malay peasants peasants, to keep the Chinese as businessmen, to keep the Indians as estate workers, because that's how it was easiest for them to control people And then the government that came into power in order to maintain power kept it that way. And with that indoctrination, some rural people just accept and believe they are at the lowest level of the social hierarchy. And once you have politics of fear being indoctrinated, it's not just 60 over years, you know, this is 70, 80 years where people are telling you, this is your position, this is your creed, this is your lot in life, and if you move away from this, you lose everything. Because you're already at the bottom of the social hierarchy, because you're a peasant, farmer, fisherman. And that's what they called us, you know, the colonial powers. They called rural people peasants if you read this colonial literature. I mean, how offensive can you get? But they put that in there, and then you have, well, the royal hierarchy is such, right? When all they have is that, and then you try and take away their identities, there's nothing left. This is generations of indoctrination. The encouraging thing, if you try and be positive about it, is that there are a lot of young voters who are trying to look beyond that, even in the rural areas. There are young voters who are willing to go against the generational support and look at economic issues to realize that corruption is rife and we need to do something about it. My hope is that they then breed less racist offspring, and that eventually, after the older folks die off, you know, things will get better. But it takes time. We need to revamp our education system, because what we're teaching in schools is making it worse, because the teachers who are teaching are putting in racial and religious divides. We need to reduce the divisive religious interpretations that are going out and telling people, you are such and such religion, you are better than others, you need to separate yourself from others. As I mentioned just now, that the rally was all in white takes it to a whole other level. Ethnic divide is one thing, but religious divide is worse. And we're going, I feel like we've regressed in that sense. Because once you start messing with people's fears of the afterlife, nothing can supersede that, because At the bottom of it all, when I hear people speak, they will do anything it takes to get into heaven. And it's a greater purpose. You know, it's a greater purpose than how you live day by day. And that can quickly deteriorate into something worse. I don't know how we're going to overcome it. I've sort of absorbed some of the despair in the rural areas. So hopefully the younger generations can overcome that. The thing that we're not saying or speaking is, yes, there's a rural issue. You know, all these people in Kelantan Terengganu, they clearly voted past. They came in for this rally in KL. But even within the urban areas, there are very, very, very staunch conservative religious people who are part of the urban areas, who are part of the middle class. And at the end of the day, yes, they might be friends with you of a different race, but if it comes to religion, they will want to do things a certain way to make sure that they end up in heaven, you know? So if we don't control it somehow, it could get worse.
In terms of bridging all these things that we've been talking about, in terms of quelling these fears, what's your take on, I suppose, one side potentially stoking matters and the other side trying to have to put out fires?
Yeah, I don't want to be the PM. But this is hard, man. I mean, you come into power with a whole bunch of promises that you don't expect to fulfill. You need to erase so many generations of indoctrination, repair the corruption and institutional damage that has happened. And then you have people stoking fires, as you say. They kind of have to do a lot of things at one time. They need to show that they care and that they're present, and at the same time, they need to solve the policy issues. They need to keep the urban people happy and try and bring across the rural people. They need to do everything at one time. I see that the current opposition will do whatever they can to get back into power. And the current government just has to keep fighting it, I guess. The problem is that a lot of decisions are made within an urban bubble. So in order to bring people over, as I said just now, you know, they have to get out and hear what people are saying. I don't know if it can be done, but I worry that if it's not done and people don't have something physical in front of them as a positive experience to combat the cyber chatter, the racist chatter that they're getting, they are not going to, these people who are voting in the next election, they're not going to be able to see that it's worth taking the risk of losing identity, religion, and royalty to move forward to a better overall Malaysia. Because you have to understand that in rural areas, maybe national needs are not as important as being able to put food on the table and getting into heaven.
Serena, thank you so much for joining us. We've been speaking today with Serena Abdul Rahman, Visiting Fellow at the Malaysian Studies Program at the ICS Yusof Ishak Institute. And we've been looking back at, GE14, which happened in 2018, particularly through the lens of the rural voter. You are listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my, BFM 89.9, the business station.